From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us. On today's show, my colleague Nikolai Mather joins me for a deep dive into the lawsuit filed by the Pender Topsail Post and Voice, known by many simply as the Pender Post, against Pender County and three of its commissioners. The lawsuit itself has some complicated moving parts, but it's also taking place at a time of significant change in Pender County. But first, we're taking a look at recent reporting on the state of DEI in North Carolina higher education from our friends at the Assembly, who partnered with five student newspapers. Working with the Daily Tar Heel at Chapel Hill, the Chronicle at Duke, Niner Times at UNC Charlotte, the Old Gold and Black at Wake Forest, and the Seahawk here at UNC Wilmington, the Assembly dug into how both public and private colleges and universities in North Carolina are navigating the complicated and sometimes uncertain terrain of DEI. All right, I'm here with Erin Gretzinger from the Assembly, and along with her fellow higher education reporter Matt Hartman, she led a team of reporters from college newspapers around the state to do a project reporting on DEI in North Carolina. Headline for the article is, "In North Carolina, it's Do or DEI." It's a fascinating, in-depth piece of reporting that we'll have online at WHQR.org, so you can check it out. But I wanted to have Erin in the studio so she could kind of walk people through some of the reporting. It's great stuff. Erin, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much.
So yeah, the first thing I wanted to ask was about this partnership that you guys had with the college papers.
We started working with the student newspapers earlier this year on a long-form reporting project, and the students got to determine the topic that we were going to focus on. And immediately the thing that jumped out to the five student papers we were working with was DEI. And we were working with both student newspapers at public schools and private schools, and DEI efforts have just radically changed in the past year or so on both those campuses. And I think that's one thing that the series really tries to get to the heart of, is just how rapidly this landscape has shifted. And it has really put administrators in a difficult position, trying to navigate, you know, what is acceptable, what is not, trying not to overcomply, but also, for obvious reasons, being afraid to not comply. So it's very challenging for administrators to navigate this space, for faculty and students who are desperate for more information, but finding themselves at their sort of a void there. So that's essentially the partnership was formed, exploring those questions. And it was the Assembly's higher ed team. So myself, Matt Hartman and Emily Stevenson, working with five student newspapers, the Daily Tar Heel at UNC Chapel Hill, the Chronicle at Duke University, the Old Golden Black at Wake Forest University, Niner Times at UNC Charlotte, and the Seahawk at UNC Wilmington.
The shift to removing DEI, as you mentioned, this happened really rapidly. You know, what did your reporting show about how the winds shifted on this so quickly?
Up until last year, DEI efforts were sort of the status quo across the UNC system. The UNC system's policy was DEI. You know, in 2019, the Board of Governors had mandated that every UNC campus have a chief diversity officer. After the killing of George Floyd, they had an equity task force that made recommendations to increase DEI efforts. So as the UNC system was pursuing these DEI-related initiatives, we started to see the tide shift in other states. So in red states like Texas and Florida, anti-DEI legislation was gaining steam. That started to really pick up around 2023 after some model legislation emerged from conservative advocacy groups that really focused in on DEI as a discriminatory woke ideology. And conservative critics really targeted that. And that's what the legislation was focused on. And as that was happening in Texas and Florida, we started to hear Republican leaders in North Carolina float whether they should take up a similar effort and axe DEI programs at public colleges. So essentially, the UNC system was feeling this pressure last year and decided to act on its own, kind of anticipating that if they didn't do something, the legislature would. And they'd moved to repeal its former DEI policies and replace them with what they called a new equality policy. And on the most basic level, that policy directed campuses to stay neutral on political controversies of the day. That resulted, you know, in effect, killing DEI offices across the UNC system. A bunch of positions were eliminated and or realigned. And it caused a bunch of other programming ripple effects that we're still seeing play out today as campuses continually strive to be complying with that policy that was initiated almost a year ago now. So obviously the landscape has shifted a lot for public colleges, and private colleges are feeling that pressure as well, especially since President Donald Trump took office.
Right. That's another thing I want to ask about, is that this isn't just a North Carolina public school policy change. It's also been kind of a cultural change. And also now there's been a lot of pressure from the Trump administration on Harvard, Columbia, other elite universities to, you know, steer away from DEI or risk, you know, losing some federal grants and stuff like that. So here in North Carolina, what does your reporting show about how DEI shifts have looked at public universities versus private universities like Duke?
Absolutely. Both public and private colleges are feeling the heat now, especially since Donald Trump took office for a second term. His second day, he made an executive order targeting DEI across all organizations that receive public funding. And that's where you started to really see this pressure, you know, and I think Columbia, Harvard, these institutions have been in the headlines a lot, but a lot of private schools have been thinking about this throughout the spring semester. And that's definitely what we saw with our student reporting partners at Duke and Wake Forest. While the schools were continuing DEI efforts, they still had offices. It's still written into their their institutional commitments and, you know, guidelines that these are their goals related to diversity. Those things still existed and persisted this spring semester. However, under the surface, I think a lot of students sensed, and faculty, that something was changing at the private schools. While they were speaking out on issues like research funding cuts and immigration and international student visas, these schools were pretty tight-lipped on DEI. So people really didn't know what was going on until the end of the spring semester. Students and faculty finally got a more concrete answer on where their institutions stood. And both Duke and Wake Forest announced within days of the end of the semester that they were launching reviews of their DEI efforts and would focus instead on what they call, you know, inclusive excellence. And that in and of itself is sort of reframing again, or signaling that they're trying to reframe these efforts in this era where DEI efforts are under attack. And at both Duke and Wake Forest, you know, we saw these changes aren't entirely set in stone yet, but they've signaled that there are going to be changes and we'll learn more this fall.
So I know some of the debate leading up to removing DEI from the UNC system had to do with concerns about compelled speech and discrimination against students, and less about the content of specific classes. And that's, in some cases, made it confusing for administrators and professors to figure out what runs afoul of the new equality policy and what doesn't. Can you say a little bit about that?
I think one of the hallmarks of this debate we're going through currently with DEI is, what is DEI? I think you see conservatives often using different words even to describe DEI, like division, extremism, ideology, trying to convey that what they see in DEI is what you just outlined: divisive, discriminatory policies, pushing perhaps liberal ideas on students, concerns about compelled speech. You know, the arguments run in that sort of vein. Where on the other side, campuses are confused on what all is being maybe lumped under this bigger label of DEI. We heard concerns about, what about student support services for rural students, or in general, again, students of color, things that are designed to maybe recruit students or help new first generation students acclimate to campus. There are a bunch of programs that it wasn't quite clear, and campuses certainly weren't considering this word DEI, but there were questions about whether this could be lumped in amid this broader debate. And trying to set that line or draw that line in the sand was really difficult for administrators this past year, as we saw the policy changes come from the university system, as we saw more language, very vague language, and many executive orders coming out of the White House. Administrators, it was really upon them to determine what has to stay and what has to go. And I think one faculty assembly leader likened it to, you're driving on the road and you know there's cops watching, but you don't know the speed limit. And I think that is the perfect way to describe the regulatory environment that campuses have found themselves in.
Exactly. I love that metaphor. It really dials it in for people. And I think, you know, this is a little granular, but issues like, for example, if you had, hypothetically, great black authors of the 20th century course as part of an English degree, there were some places where a course like that might be a core requirement, so you had to take it, but other places where it would be one of several options where you could take that course as part of satisfying your requirements, and professors would say, well, now there's choice, you don't have to take it, and also you don't have to be an English major. You could go into a STEM field or, you know, something like that. So I think even at the level of like individual class selection, there was some, I'll just say, fuzziness around, you know, are we complying with the policy or are we not?
Yes. And this is one area where, again, everything has shifted really quickly. Just last year, last May, when the equality policy went out from the UNC system, that was targeted at administrative efforts, student support services, administrative roles, and it was very explicit in saying this has nothing to do with courses, faculty, teaching. That was all explicitly carved out in this equality policy passed just last year, which made a lot of faculty feel more comfortable at the time. But as we've moved forward throughout the year and now into the Trump administration, a lot of that has come under more intense scrutiny. And we saw the UNC system take a pretty drastic step in February this year in response to one of President Trump's executive orders, in which they banned all graduation requirements related to DEI. Now, that is a really complicated thing to define. I think campuses in and of themselves have acknowledged that this is a squishy thing. And while all general education courses related to DEI, there was no exceptions. If there was like a U.S. diversity requirement at Chapel Hill, that immediately went away, even though there were many courses you could take to fulfill that requirement. So, of course, some faculty were nervous about that. But the really big gray area that campuses have been working through this spring is major-specific requirements. And within different majors and academic programs, what types of courses could persist? And what we were hearing as reporters were people in Africana studies programs or Black studies programs, gender and women's studies programs, wondering, in this new era with the definition of DEI that seems to keep growing and growing, are our disciplines at risk? And there was a real lack of information that left people feeling very scared. There was one student at UNC Charlotte who we spoke with who hadn't been to school in decades and went back to class to finish her degree in Africana studies because she was worried the major wouldn't be available anymore. So there is a lack of information about what is being included in these mandates and that is not, that the UNC system's major specific requirements mandate really gets to the heart of.
So one other thing I want to touch on, and your reporting gets into this a little bit, is the universities now have reporting requirements to the UNC system head office. But there's been another angle on this story where self-styled journalists are kind of going, I would say, undercover, perhaps might be the right phrase, and trying to root out people who are doing DEI under other terms or doing it surreptitiously. Can you say a little bit about that phenomenon?
Yes. So there's this group called Accuracy in Media, which describes itself as an undercover journalistic organization. And it's important to know here that the Society of Professional Journalists considers undercover reporting usually unethical unless in extreme circumstances. But this group has released secretly recorded videos at 4 UNC system schools now. It says it has 6 videos total. We have not seen the other 2. But in those videos, it tries to demonstrate what it claims are administrators still pursuing DEI-related practices, despite the UNC system's policy banning those practices. Now, these videos are edited. It's hard to know the full context. But these videos have, for the most part, led to those employees no longer being employed at their institutions. So 3 of those schools, UNC Asheville, Western Carolina University, and UNC Charlotte, they have all said that those individuals featured in those videos are no longer employed. They've declined to clarify if they were fired or resigned. And at the same time, we're hearing from UNC Wilmington that they are conducting an investigation into 2 employees. That is, there's no conclusion on that yet, but we're keeping an eye on what's happening there. And this group, Accuracy in Media, has done this at other schools across the country. This is part of their framework, really, in trying to shine light on what they say is continuing DEI ideology rooted in colleges and universities across the country. And I think these videos really show, as you were alluding to, sort of the risks in navigating this period as a campus employee. It shows that reorienting DEI programs to student success efforts, which is what the system openly encouraged campuses to do, still doesn't appear to be enough for DEI critics who really believe that this is something that goes deeper and that campus administrators are really being forced to think about how do we talk about these efforts? What are these efforts? What can we still do? What can we not do? How can we talk about these things in this current age? And I think it also shows, you know, that this is something legislators are still paying attention to. Republican Rep. Dave Willis referenced these videos when he was introducing a bill aimed at eliminating DEI public higher education as evidence that state legislators should do more. So all these videos go to show to me, really, again, the environment, the really uncertain environment that administrators are navigating and the really intense scrutiny that is still aimed at these efforts.
Well, look, this is a great reporting project. Anything else you would want to add on the way out here?
I think the only other detail is that in the end, 14 out of 16 campuses requested exemptions to the major specific requirement. Yeah. And 95% of those exemptions were around programs like social work, nursing, education, counseling, and psychology. And most of the exemptions had to do with licensure and accreditation requirements, which is also interesting because the UNC system is pursuing creating its own accreditor because accreditors have attracted a lot of DEI scrutiny.
A whole other can of worms that we can open.
Yes.
All right. Well, Aaron Gretzinger from the Assembly, who led a team along with Matt Hartman of college reporters from around the state. Great reporting. Great work. Please give our kudos to the rest of that team. And thank you so much for being here today. All right. Well, we've got to take a quick break. But when we come back, my colleague Nikolai Mather joins us to help unpack a lawsuit in Pender County that, in some ways, cuts to the heart of how the conservative community is going through some significant changes. I'm Ben Schachman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for staying with us. Earlier this month, Andy and Katie Pettigrew, owners of the Pender Topsail Post and Voice, known by many as the Pender Post, filed a lawsuit against Pender County and three of its commissioners. Randy Burton, Brent Springer, and Jerry Groves, referred to by Pettigrew as the BOC3, voted to stop doing business with the Pender Post, after years of paying tens of thousands of dollars annually to post the county's legal notices. The only real reason given? Andy Pettigrew's opinion column, The Watchman on the Wall, which has strongly criticized the BOC3, sometimes with political cartoons that, many would say justifiably, Burton, Springer, and Groves have found insulting. The Watchman on the Wall is an Old Testament reference. It's a nod to Pettigrew's religious roots and the seriousness with which he takes his work. But some think his opinions go too far, especially since he is also the publisher of the Post and a journalist whose byline appears on more straight-laced reporting. And look, this is a line I myself walk all the time here at WHQR. But even I think some of Pettigrew's columns, even though they're labeled opinion, go beyond what I would consider to be the limits of editorial discretion, at least for WHQR. Pettigrew would probably politely disagree. As he's told me, he feels a responsibility, not just to the Pender Post, but to Pender County. And like Pettigrew himself, Pender County is deeply conservative, but it's also changing, and the resulting tension is the backstory to this legal battle. I am here with my colleague Nikolai Mather to talk about Pender County. It's hard to talk about Pender County right now without talking about the lawsuit between the Post and Voice and Pender County. Nikolai Mather, what is going on here?
It is a major lawsuit indeed, Ben. In the first week of July, the Pender County newspaper, the Pender Topsail Post and Voice, sued the county along with three commissioners, Randy Burton, Jerry Groves, and Brent Springer. Those three commissioners voted to pull county legal ads from the paper this year. Now, Andy and Katie Pettigrew are the owners of the Pender Topsail Post and Voice. They are the plaintiffs in this lawsuit, and they allege that by voting to redirect county legal advertisements to the Wilmington Star News, which is the closest local paper to Pender County, the county commissioners in questions, and it seems by extension the county, are suppressing the Pender Post's First Amendment rights. And they say that's because the only given reason that these commissioners had for the county switching over is because the Pettigrews ran several columns and cartoons that were insulting to the commissioners. And Groves and Springer and Burton didn't really want to spend county money on that kind of thing. Groves actually proposed that the county switch over from Pender Post to Star News during a retreat in March of this year. Then in the meeting in April, on April 22nd, just before the board voted to pull funding, he spoke out about the matter. At one point, he held up a copy of the Pender Post's opinion page, which featured a cartoon depicting him as a baby.
Mr. Chair, let me jump in.
Yes, sir.
It's time to cut through the chase. Watch where he puts the camera. It'll be straight to me. And that's fine. He's been doing it for 27 months. And
Commissioner Groves,
this isn't personal.
Let's just be professional.
But let's just cut through the chase.
Let's be professional.
This is what we as three county commissioners have to put up with.
You're a public figure. What happens?
And the citizens' money are paying for this, and it's time for it to stop.
So you just heard Burton asking Jerry Groves to stay professional while he's, like, voicing his criticism, and a meeting attendee who was there calling him a public figure and saying this is basically what you have to put up with as a politician. Groves also mentioned someone pointing a camera at him. He was referring to the Pettigrews who attended that meeting that night. I believe they sit in the same place in the first row every time they come and cover one of these meetings. It was a pretty heated exchange.
All right, so there's a lot to unpack here. I think the first thing we should talk about is we're talking about a legal notice, or the legal notices the Pender County posts in the Pender Post, which is what a lot of people sort of affectionately call this paper, because it's a collection of three local papers that have all sort of been brought under the same house. So if I say the Pender Post, I'm talking about
that's why. Yeah, the Pettigrews bought it in 2013, and they say that they call it the Pender Post out of basically affection for the guy who started the Pender Post.
That's right. Yeah, there's multiple papers dating back to the late 1800s. But anyway, so this is a longtime institution, and for a long time the county has put these legal notices. That's like if there's a lien on your house,
maybe if you're changing your name or something like that, and you have to list it in order to make sure that creditors aren't, like, you're not trying to scam out of creditors or anything like that.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. And there's legislation out there that could change this to be an online kind of thing, but right now, and we'll get into this a bit more later, you got to put it in a physical paper and mail it out. And it's big business. I don't think people realize this. In the case of Pender County, according to court records, in 2024, I believe Pender County spent somewhere around $85,000.
$85,000 sounds about right, yeah.
And in addition to that, the Pender Post also publishes for free other stuff for the county. But that's a significant amount of money for a small local paper. So that's thing one. It sounds like a, you know, trifling legal detail, but it really is a big part of local newspaper business.
It is very major. And in fact, because the county did ultimately vote to pull this legal advertising funding from this paper, Andy Pettigrew told Port City Daily that he estimates the paper has lost $80,000 in revenue as a result of these ads being pulled, and that these cuts translated to having to fire a longtime staff member. Bobby Norris covered sports for the Pender Post for 15 years, and ultimately the Pettigrews had to let him go.
Right. So it's had a serious impact. And I've spoken to Andy Pettigrew off the record, so I don't want to speak out of turn for him. But he did tell me a couple months ago that he did not intend to take this laying down and that there was possibly some litigation coming. This is that litigation.
Yep.
So they hired Mike Tadick, who you may have heard us talk about in the past. He's North Carolina's leading First Amendment attorney. He's part of a team that has, in many different kinds of situations, stepped in to defend the press.
He's a heavy hitter. Yeah.
He's a heavy hitter, yeah.
Yeah. And in addition to the First Amendment allegations they make in this lawsuit, which I think Tadick definitely speaks to as somebody who, like, works with the First Amendment every day, they also make a bunch of other allegations. You know, in cutting off county money, Pender County is violating the state constitution. First, it's free press protections. And second, the entitlement of all North Carolinians to the fruits of their labor. Very poetic turn of phrase, basically meaning, give me my money.
But it is the heart and soul of a lot of lawsuits that I've covered, because there are a lot of situations where maybe you're pushed out of a job or made so uncomfortable that you resign.
Mm-hmm.
And traditional worker protection laws don't really protect you because you weren't fired.
Yes.
But if you can say, hey, look, you made this so uncomfortable for me, I couldn't keep doing this job. Now I'm out of a job. You've deprived me of the fruit of my labor. So that's where that law comes in over and over again. We've seen that. The other interesting thing is that if you have a constitutional case, in this case, we're talking about both the state and United States Constitution, that trumps what's called government immunity, because most of the time, it is very difficult to sue the government. There's this old common law phrase, the king could do no wrong, which made it, for most of American history, almost impossible to sue the government. Here in North Carolina, that's changed, but only like in the last 15 years or so. And the exemption is, it is almost impossible to sue the government unless your constitutional rights have been violated. So you will often see that in a lawsuit just to get over the first hurdle, which is the government saying, well, you can't sue me.
That's true. And at the same time, I kind of wonder whether going off the state constitution and the First Amendment is necessarily going to work in their favor. I mean, obviously, you and I are not attorneys or legal experts. We're journalists, just like Andy Pettigrew. But the allegation that their free speech was suppressed by the county choosing not to fund the paper that prints these insulting cartoons, it seems to me to be a pretty difficult case to make. What do you think?
Well, yeah, you know, we've actually had a lot of experience with this over the last couple of months when people are talking about federal budget cuts to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which funds NPR. We've had, you know, fans of NPR saying this is a First Amendment violation, and that's not really what's going on. The First Amendment doesn't say that NPR has the right to be funded by the U.S. government.
Right, yeah.
There's lots of other considerations about how CPB works. It's supposed to be an independent agency. The White House traditionally is not allowed to rescind or pull back money that's already been approved by Congress.
Lots of
other things going on, but it's not really a 1A case. So in this case, when it's the Pender Post versus Pender County, it's a little hard for me to see how it's a direct First Amendment restriction, in part because even though it's taken a financial hit, the Pender Post can still publish. No one has stopped Andy Pettigrew from publishing the Watchman on the Wall column, which includes the cartoons that county commissioners found so offensive. I think if Andy Pettigrew had been arrested...
Or if they, like, prevented him from coming into meetings or something like
exactly,
that.
Exactly, yeah. Like, if a sheriff's deputy had blocked him at the door. Or
yes.
He was thrown out of a meeting, which is something we've seen here in New Hanover County, mm-hmm. and people filed First Amendment cases. Or, like, if the Post had been shut down entirely because the county, like, denied a building permit that they needed to repair after a storm or condemned their building using
right.
eminent domain, that would be, like, pretty cut-and-dry retaliation. But in this case, it's really murky. It is, like, I hate to say wait and see, but it is kind of wait and see to see how this moves through the court system.
Some more details on why this is kind of like a wait and see situation. They invoke General Statute 1597A a few times in parentheses A. And that statute in North Carolina concerns legal advertisements. It's pretty clear about what publications are allowed to publish those ads, those based in or contiguous to a county, those publishing weekly, and those that have been issued in the county for at least 6 months prior to printing the legal ad. But it also says that a publication needs a periodicals permit from the U.S. Post Office in order to print legal ads. We know that Pender Post has that because Andy has told us that. Does Star News have that?
So according to Gannett, which is the massive multimedia company that owns Star News, they do. They told me.
You got up with Gannett?
I actually emailed Star News and Gannett came back to me and said very tersely, they're like, we have a periodicals permit in Pender County. That's all they said.
Okay, got you. Cool.
So that is their opinion. There's some ambiguity about whether or not that permit is enough or it has to be in conjunction with publishing in the county. I think that is somewhat up to interpretation, and that interpretation could come, right, from the clerk of courts.
Yeah, in theory, it could come from the clerk of courts, and that's another thing that's a little bit up in the air with this case. You know, we have two competing ideas here, basically. So the Pettigrews say and have told the press repeatedly that the clerk of court says Star News can't legally substitute Pender Post's legal ads. Now, I have tried to get up with Elizabeth Craver over in Pender County about this, but my calls and emails to her on the subject have so far gone unanswered. She hasn't confirmed whether or not that's true, that Star News cannot substitute Pender Post for legal advertisements. Also, there's a very confusing exchange at the April 22nd meeting where Pender County Attorney Trey Thurman told the commission that he had spoken to one of Liz Craver's assistants, and that assistant's answer led him to believe that Star News would be acceptable, which directly contradicted something that Jimmy Tate alleges he heard from the clerk of court. So here's that exchange.
Did you contact the clerk?
Yes, and it's my understanding that, yes, the Star News is accepted as advertising for that, and there are
so the clerk
pending.
Told you that. Clerk of court.
I did not speak with her. I spoke with one of her assistants.
That's not what she told me.
But
the clerk
not,
told me specifically that she would not accept it or would not be accepted.
Then that is her decision. Yes.
Yeah. So they didn't really seem to figure out whether the clerk directly said she was okay with it, but the matter ended up going to a vote like 5 seconds later, anyways.
Right. So that is Commissioner Jimmy Tate, who we should note is a longtime acquaintance of the Pettigrews.
Yes.
And the question, again, is this a legal other option? But there's another question beyond that I think we should bring up really quickly. And that is, in the course of hashing through all this, it also came up that Star News is quite a bit more expensive than the Pender Post.
Oh, yes.
You know, they broke it down in pretty granular detail. But basically, that was one thing they agreed, that is if they published these legal notices in Star News, it would cost the county quite a bit more than if they did the Pender Post. And so I've heard some people ask, well, don't they, as stewards of public money, don't they have a responsibility or obligation to go with what's usually called the lowest responsible bid? And that's something I think will probably be hashed out. It's mentioned in the lawsuit, so I think that will come out in the course of this case.
Yes, and that was actually also something that Tate hammered on quite a bit at the April 22nd meeting. He said, like, look, they're already providing this service to us at a discounted rate. A lot of my constituents can't afford to be paying out of pocket for the Star News like this, so why do we not just stick with the Pender Post? So a lot of things are still up in the air, but to complicate matters even further, there's a lot of context lying under the surface that I think we're going to need a part two for, quite frankly, because we've spoken a lot.
We really do need to do a part two. All right, we need to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will have that context and backstory for this lawsuit. I'm Ben Schachman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for staying with us as we return to our conversation with my colleague Nikolai Mather. We're talking about the changing political dynamics in Pender County and how that has provided the background for the lawsuit between the Pender Post and Pender County and three of its commissioners. All right, I'm back with Nikolai Mather for round two, and we need to sort of pull the camera back. Because to really appreciate this lawsuit between the Pender Post and Pender County, you kind of got to understand what Pender County is and what's been going on, especially lately. There's been a lot of things changing and a lot of moving parts. So let's get into that. Let's get some of that context.
Absolutely. Yeah. So Pender County is kind of the classic southeastern North Carolina county in that it's lying on the beach. It's undergoing a tremendous amount of change, a lot of it due to population influx, people coming into Pender County from other states or sometimes other places in North Carolina. It's traditionally a very isolated, very conservative county. You know, to this day, everybody on the county commission is a Republican.
But it's experienced the same kind of isolation that Wilmington has prior to the completion of I-40.
Right.
And so what we've seen there is, yeah, this explosion of growth. What we haven't really seen is kind of purple nature of Wilmington.
Yeah, or the purple nature of Brunswick County, because our Brunswick County listeners know that, and it's not even just like a transplant-related effect necessarily, but they understand that as people move there and retire there, sometimes from within North Carolina, sometimes from New York or California or other states, the politics also change. Like this past election, we saw huge, huge political change in terms of who was voting for Democrats and who was voting for Republicans in Brunswick County. Pender County, you're still not quite seeing that. Like in this last gubernatorial election, we saw them solidly go for Mark Robinson even after Mark Robinson did Mark Robinson things.
And lost in Brunswick County, which is still a fairly conservative county.
Yes, absolutely.
So here's what one person told me is that you can think of Pender County this way, is that it's solid red, but it's not a monolith.
No.
And in fact, you see that in the primary elections more than anywhere else. In fact, the general elections are usually kind of boring in Pender County because there's almost never a Democratic candidate. But we see a lot of energy and a lot of, you know, civic engagement around those primaries because there are some very different flavors of conservatism and republicanism in Pender County.
Absolutely. Yeah, the way that I tend to explain it to people who ask me about Pender County is being a Republican, it is basically just the interstitial fluid that you operate in, essentially, in the county. It's not necessarily declaring anything about your political beliefs. It just means you are on the same page as everybody else. And from there, you have your differences in how to approach things. So, for example, what we're kind of seeing right now with this iteration of the county commission is, I would argue, something of an ideological split that has grown wider and wider as time has progressed. And you can really kind of see evidence of that with Jimmy Tate. I'm going to let you take over and talk a little bit about this, Ben, simply because you were reporting on him before I got here.
Sure. So Jimmy Tate is he's a black commissioner. He was on the board back in 2023. And at the beginning of the year, he kind of abruptly resigned. And this caught a lot of people off guard. There were a number of further right, I would say, or far right media, quote unquote, outlets that were attacking Jimmy Tate, in some cases, just some hateful remarks. But in other cases, you know, specific claims that he had violated election law by not having his primary residence in the county.
And I should add, too, I just did research on this basically when we were getting ready to do this piece, but it wasn't just these media outlets publishing this stuff. It was like people showing up repeatedly at these meetings to harass him and say, like, you don't live here, why are you here?
Right. Because, you know, Jimmy Tate is a little bit more center right than some of the further right folks who were upset with Tate and wanted him basically pushed out of office. Things got nasty. There were homophobic slurs, there were racial slurs. Most of the frustration that Tate expressed seemed to be about racial harassment, and that's ultimately why he stepped down in 2023. And as that was happening, we were seeing, not just in elections, but in public comments on social media, we were feeling this sort of rightward tilt in Pender County. Not that the whole county was going that way, but we're hearing more and more vocal people who felt like maybe the traditional Republican establishment were, you know, rhinos or the good old boy club, or they weren't representing everyday people in Pender. So there were some hateful elements of this, but also just some populist elements of this saying that, like, quote unquote, the people needed a voice.
Yeah.
So all of that is the backstory that is behind Tate now returning, you know, being appointed by the Pender County GOP to replace Ken Smith, who left the Board of Commissioners when he basically was relocated out of the county. But I think that shows, you know, the establishment GOP in Pender County picked Tate. You know, they could have gone with someone who was further to the right, but they didn't. So to me, it feels like that tension is still there.
Exactly. And we should also say, too, that to my knowledge, and I don't know if you could speak to this as well, Ben, like, it's these things weren't necessarily being expressed out in the open by commissioners on the board. That's not at all what we're saying. What we are saying is we tended to see a lot of constituents, like vocal, politically minded constituents, leaning harder and harder into the sort of far right ideology that we're seeing all over the United States at this time. And I want to be very clear, too, that the BOC3, as Andy Pettigrew has christened Groves, Burton, and Springer, they themselves don't seem to be particularly far right either, but their supporters kind of seem to be. And there have been some instances where they've expressed slightly more far right opinions than, say, Brad George or than Tate. One thing that I noticed actually earlier this year, back in February, this was when the commission was considering a resolution to join the federal 287G program. Listeners might already know this, but 287G is a partnership between local law enforcement and ICE and other federal immigration authorities that basically empowers local officials to act like immigration authorities. Like, under 287G, deputies can ask for immigration status, they can detain people they think are non-citizens, and they can also execute ICE warrants on folks in custody. And they were considering this for a lot of reasons, but ultimately, Sheriff Alan Cutler, who showed up to the meeting that night, told the commission he didn't think that the partnership was necessary because it just would put a strain on county resources. Like, basically, he was like, the feds are asking us to do their job, and I'm not comfortable putting my boys up for that. And Randy Burton didn't really contest that, but during the meeting, he did call illegal immigration a problem.
It's an unfortunate thing that many jurisdictions in the country are dealing with that. Like in Riley's family, we need to ask them how they feel.
So Lakin Riley being the University of Georgia student who was murdered by an undocumented immigrant. And Riley's death was absolutely a tragedy. I actually lived in Athens for a little while, and I know the exact spot where she was murdered. The incident itself has been used as a sort of rallying call for many conservatives to crack down on undocumented immigrants, particularly those with criminal records. Not saying at all that, like, it's wrong for him to be concerned or moved or even infuriated by Lakin Riley's death. What I am saying is I think that there can be a bit of a dog whistle association with bringing up her death in the context of cracking down on undocumented immigrants in Pender County.
Sure. I mean, we heard from people who were just genuinely sad that a young woman's life had been taken. And we also saw things like Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, shout, say her name at Biden as he was, you know, coming into the chamber to
yes.
do the State of the Union. So it can mean a lot of different things. It can kind of be coded different ways. And I think this situation was interesting because there are, you know, conservative Republicans who would certainly like to see immigration reform. But in Pender County and sort of in agricultural North Carolina in general, migrant workers are a huge part of the ecosystem. The other half of Pender County, the coastal half, leans heavily on the tourism industry, on the service and hospitality industry, which also employs a lot of immigrants. And there's not the same animosity against, you know, people who have come to this country legally or illegally for that group of sort of like more classical conservatives in Pender County than there are for some folks on the far right, where we see people deliberately picking the worst possible examples of things that migrants have done and just using just dehumanizing language and stuff like that. And it's a spectrum, right? It's not one or the other, but we've seen through these conversations the kind of nuances of conservatism in Pender County.
Yeah. And just to make a note, too, another reason why that meeting was so interesting to me was because I'm kind of used to, as I go through these rural areas in southeastern North Carolina, hearing lots of opinions that you might not necessarily expect from Republicans, right? So, for example, when I did a piece on a drag show that happened out in Leland, the people that I spoke to at that drag show, most of them were registered Republicans. The people who own the bar where they're putting on this drag show, they were registered Republicans. But they were very, very vocally pro-LGBTQ. And I want to put an emphasis on the T, too, because, like, they had trans performers at this drag show. And they were like, we support them. We stand by them. We don't care what people are saying about them on Facebook. Like, they're not welcome. People who hate on these folks are not welcome here, which you wouldn't necessarily expect from Republicans unless, you know, you live in Brunswick County. And I've come to expect that same sort of dynamic as I go up to Pender County, you know, talking to Republicans, they're going to say things that you wouldn't necessarily expect a Republican to traditionally say. What stood out to me about this meeting was the folks who were standing up and speaking out against 287G were Democrats. I don't think I've met a single Democrat in Pender County ever, like in the 2 years that I've been working here, just incidentally. So it was very fascinating to me to see like an actual Democrat presence at a public meeting, period, and then also speaking out about this issue. What was less surprising to me was Republicans saying, no, actually, we shouldn't do 287G, even if they did couch it in language around, oh, this is just going to be wasting county resources. Ultimately, they're still saying, this is not a problem in our county. Why are we acting like it is?
And I won't go too far down this rabbit hole, but it's worth noting that in general, the rural South is known for having kind of a distaste or distrust or disinterest in the federal government.
You know?
Yeah, they... And it's for a lot of reasons. I mean, there's a lot of cultural history here in North Carolina, whether it's, you know, the bootlegging backstory behind NASCAR or the way that like state and federal authorities just kind of neglected parts of the coast. Like, look at I-40. You know, that's the federal government. For decades, there was no effort to build a major roadway. And there's also just sort of a independent small government mindset that's been flipped on its head a little bit. The Trump administration campaigned to those people, to people who are distrustful of institutions, first and foremost, the government, said he was going to drain the swamp and get rid of all the people that they don't trust in the federal government. Now it's weird, right? Because now you have people who, for generations, have been distrustful and disinterested in the federal government, now very emphatically rooting for the head of the federal government, the president of the United States, and sort of fanboying and fangirling for, you know, Pam Bondi and Kash Patel.
Well, by that same token, too, it's like a lot of people cheered on Trump and now he's in office. And something that I've been hearing a lot from folks in rural areas is like, oh, my God, is he cutting my Medicaid? Like, or what's going to happen to the hospitals out here that are funded in large part because of Medicaid? In a strange way, you're also seeing some factions of people out in rural areas turning against Trump again after being basically bought in to trust the federal government. It's a really complicated thing. And I think that's the big takeaway here.
Yeah, that's kind of the milieu. What an NPR word. That's kind of the mess that Andy Pettigrew and the Pender Post are entering. That's the fray that they're entering here.
I think it's probably very hard for him to draw a sort of editorial line over his opinions when he also runs this small town newspaper. And at the same time, I think that he's maybe identified a strain of politics that he doesn't necessarily see a place for in Pender County. I think that the whole place is kind of undergoing a lot of change, and it's hard to sort of capture that while also keeping a cool head, you know?
I think that's well said, yeah. And I think that sort of brings it full circle because Andy Pettigrew definitely comes from a conservative background, and this is not some woke liberal journalist elite member of the Fourth Estate out there in Pender County just trying to pick a fight. And what he's told me, again, without, you know, going too deep into conversations we've had, is that, you know, he very much sees the role of a community paper as being a bit different than the role of, say, the Star News, in that he has a level of investment, a level of sweat equity, a level of skin in the game that maybe a more, you know, corporate paper that's, you know, headquartered in Wilmington might have. And he seems to feel like that requires him to go beyond just the straight news reporting. And there's also plenty of straight news reporting in the Pender Post. But the Watchman on the Wall column is clearly opinion.
Yes.
And it's, you know, at times very spicy opinion. Probably a lot spicier than anything we'd be allowed to serve up here at WHQR. But I think you're right. I think what he has identified is a strain of politics that doesn't resonate with an older generation of conservative but basically moderate Pender County folks. There are some real extremes on the right. I'm not saying everyone we've talked about fits the bill, but it seems like some of what he's writing about is worried about that, is worried about anti-democratic moves that the commission or the school board might be making moves towards. And I'm not specifically talking about Pettigrew here, but I've heard from fans of the Post that they started noticing this years ago during the book bans. This was 2022-2023, when Pender County eliminated a number of books. And there were folks who probably might not have agreed with some of the stuff in those books, but felt that it was kind of illiberal. I talked to one guy in Burgaw when he found out that one of the books that they wanted to ban was Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five, which is basically a humanist plea for no more foreign wars.
Literally.
You know, and he was a big Vonnegut fan. He said, yeah, I remember reading it in high school, and I just don't understand why we're banning this. It struck him as being illiberal in the classic lowercase l liberal sense of being like, this is not who we are. It's not what we do. And I've talked to other people who probably wouldn't have really cared about the ban, but just felt like with all the issues in Pender County, infrastructure falling behind, you know, water and sewer falling behind, roads falling behind, affordable housing crushing people from a financial point of view, concerns about the farming industry, concerns about development, this was somehow occupying like huge portions of space in the news and in people's daily lives. Like, they're just like, that's why are we spending time on this culture war stuff?
Well, here's an observation that I'll make. I got on the phone with some people in Columbus County, actually, who are part of the Democratic Party out there. And we were just kind of talking about a recent bill that was passed that basically makes Columbus County school board elections partisan. It was authorized by their representative, Brendan Jones. And we were just kind of chatting about how politics has evolved in Columbus County. And one of the people that I was speaking with, Jason Ellaby, made this observation that what seems to be happening in a lot of small towns and small counties, rural areas across North Carolina and the United States generally, is suddenly you're seeing a lot of politicians more concerned with national issues, the culture war stuff, you know, very invested in like, oh, we're going to make sure DEI never enters our world, or we're going to talk about book bans, or we're going to talk about immigration, like things like that, you know, very much, I think, more in the national purview, something that you can talk about with anybody in the United States at this point. But in terms of county issues, he kind of got the sense that a lot of folks in Columbus County who are elected officials are leaving that behind. Like, instead of actually dealing with infrastructure issues, instead of dealing with the cell service problems in Pender County or something like that, they are choosing instead to focus on these issues that tend to get voters riled up, but don't necessarily translate into actionable items. You know what I mean? And I think that is maybe at the core here. Now, I'm not saying that like I'm casting an opinion with one person is right or one person is like wrong. What I mean is I think that folks are starting to grapple with commissioners both acting as just elected officials for the county and elected officials generally. We're expecting all of our elected officials nowadays to have opinions on the culture war stuff.
And I'll say, in their defense, we've seen Democrats and Republicans both do this.
Yes.
Whether it's, you know, city, town council, or county commissioners, or boards of education. But we also get a ton of questions from the public asking us to put national-level culture war questions to local officials.
Oh, all the time.
So it's the entire ecosystem of how we think about local politicians, which for decades had been fairly boring and fairly focused on, you know, the nuts and bolts of local government. It's changed, and it's not just that these folks are out there grandstanding for their base. The whole environment has changed.
The entire environment has changed, yeah. I mean, even the chair of the Columbus County GOP, who I spoke with, Sammy Hinson, he told me that like something like 20, 30 years ago, whenever they were talking about school board elections, they would only be asking questions about like, oh, how are you going to use the tax to make sure these kids are learning? Like, are you going to pay for new buses? How are we going to hire enough bus drivers? Things of that nature. And he told me now it's all about the culture war stuff. It's all about, you know, men and women's sports and, you know, like DEI. Like, what are you teaching these kids? What's in the curriculum? So anyways, I think that is kind of the split that's causing so much. I think that's one of the things that's causing so much tension between the Pender Post and the commissioners. There's lots of other factors, but we'll leave that to the attorneys to hash out.
Yes, along with the First Amendment and state constitution and all the
other and the fruits of their labor.
And the fruits of their labor. Yes. All right, lots more we'll probably have to say about this case as it evolves. But for now, Nikolai Mather, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Ben Shockman, and thanks everyone for listening.
All right. Well, that's just about all the time we have for this edition of The Newsroom. Thanks to Aaron Gretzinger and the good folks at the Assembly and my colleague Nikolai Mather. Thanks also to WHQR's program director Ken Campbell. And a fond farewell to Jonathan Furnell, who rejoined the technical team for one more tour of duty and is now headed off for the next big thing. Godspeed and go get 'em. If you missed any part of the show, you can find it at whqr.org or as a podcast, pretty much everywhere you can find podcasts. Music for today's show was provided by If These Trees Could Talk and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have comments, concerns, or an idea for a future show, email us at newsroom@whqr.org. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.